Well, welcome back to Sheep Stuff You Should Know. It's sometime in February 2021, I think, and I'm Dan Makin up here in Auburn, California, in the sunny Sierra foothills, and I'm joined, as always, by Ryan Mahoney down in Rio Vista, California. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Good talking to you again.
It's nice to see you.
Been a whole week.
And nothing's going on. You probably just, like I have, been sitting around eating ice cream and...
Gosh, I wish I was eating ice cream. Got blown away by that north wind yesterday.
Ooh, buddy. Oh, my word. You could just see the moisture suck up out of the ground, couldn't you?
I closed my eyes the whole time. Yeah, are we going to get any rain? They say a chance in a week or so, but...
They keep kind of pushing it back, which is kind of how it was early in the year, and so I don't know. I'll believe it when I go outside and get wet, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's just working its way back to average. Last year, they had just absolutely phenomenal rain year down in the Mojave Desert, and the sheep came out of there in beginning of May and weighed 130 to 40 pounds and just beautiful, beautiful feed year. And this year, they're all shipping in March because yeah, there's nothing. And you put those 2 years together, you get about average where it's supposed to be. But
that's why you never look at average, right?
No, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, you're lambing right now. You finally got some lambs on the ground?
We do. I almost had to come and steal a couple from you for my Instagram feed because I was a day late on my countdown. But we got them on the ground now. They're starting to trickle in. So. Cool. Probably 7 to 10 days, we'll have our big rush, and it'll be good.
Well, that'll be good. Anything you feel you failed to prepare, or are you ready for them?
I'm feeling pretty good about it so far. You know, you never want to brag too much about it, but knock on wood.
Yeah.
So far, no big problems and nothing I forgot to do. So.
Well, good deal.
It's always a good sign. Yeah.
I'll ask you again in a week. Hopefully it's still true.
Yeah. See if I have any hair left in a week.
Yeah. Mustache starts falling out. You know, you're in trouble.
so far, so good. And you know, it's the only silver lining to this weather.
Yeah. Beautiful lambing weather. Yeah. Man, you're going to have a great time.
Exactly.
But you get those lambing on the ground, chances are we'll get a nice cold, wet storm come through and dump them on them. Bunch of moisture, and it'll be a terrible lambing for you, but I'll finally have feed. So either one of us will be happy.
I will absolutely take the rain on lambs over drought any day.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
And you got those cool rain jackets too.
We do. Yeah. And I haven't had to use them yet this year. So
yeah, well, that's cool.
Get my money's worth. So I think you're bringing the topic today, right?
Yeah, I got a topic today. So it's a little out of my wheelhouse. So I'm asking honest questions, but I wanted to talk about kind of how I don't know how you would title it yet. We'll probably come up with something between now and when it posts. But you know, how you take an on-farm problem and turn it into a research project / how do you figure things out and test things on your farm. So kind of the first, I know with UC Extension and some of the work you do, you're involved in a lot of different sheep research projects. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be interesting to kind of take a quick 40,000 foot look on how research projects start and how they get funded. You know, where does the idea get hatched and how does it work through a system and to become an actual usable research by industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a great question. And I think there's several levels to that answer. You know, I think a lot of us, yourself included, Ryan, are doing informal research all the time, right? So we're observing something that doesn't quite make sense or that's a problem in our operation. And that forms a question in our mind and we start testing some alternatives or alternative approaches to that issue. And really that's all research is. I mean, we're finding questions about what we're doing, making a hypothesis and then testing the hypothesis. But I think at a more formal level, and this isn't meant to sound self-serving in terms of cooperative extension, but I think we're really fortunate in the US to have this land grant college system that has county-based cooperative extension folks In California in particular, I think we've got a really strong group of livestock and natural resource county-based folks. And I think where it works well is when a rancher is working with a farm advisor and asking each other questions back and forth about a particular problem that's going on the ranch. And from that, I think then a more formal process evolves that the farm advisor or the researcher starts to work with people at the campus level to bring research dollars to that particular question. I think, go ahead.
At that campus level, you take the university system, so like Davis or something like that. Mm-hmm. What or how are those projects actually being done? Are they being done by like a grad student for a master's thesis? Are they being done by a professor getting side funding for a project? Are they being, who are actually doing those boots on the ground type studies?
All kinds of ways. Everything you mentioned there would be a method for getting those studies done. So maybe I'll use a couple of examples of research that I'm involved in to illustrate that. And I think one of these you're part of too. So working with a campus specialist looking at irrigated pasture management across Northern California. And that project is led by this campus specialist, but she collaborates with farm advisors like me and like Morgan Doran, who's in your area, to do a lot of the field work, to go out and collect data and clip plots and record information. That research is funded by a grant that Dr. Leslie Roach got from the California Department of Water Resources. And so she's got funding then to hire a grad student to work on the data analysis and kind of do the grunt work, if you will, on analyzing the data that we're collecting. So that's one method. We've identified an issue that's of interest to the ranching community. We've gone out and got funding to be able to hire people and get equipment to do the research. And the results of that research project then would be workshops that we do for ranchers. It would be publications that we put out for California Cattlemen's Association or the California Wool Growers Association. And then it would also be scientific publications based on that data collected and analysis. So another project that I'm doing is this livestock guardian dog behavior research. And so far I haven't found any grant funding to do it, but I've cobbled together funding for some equipment and have spent my own time working with other ranchers to really track the behavior of their guard dogs so that we can build a better understanding of what the dogs are doing. And again, the work product of that's going to be workshops and articles and publications. But because I get paid by the university to do research that matters to my community, I'm kind of funding that with my own time. So there's a whole variety of approaches to getting things like that done.
So to kind of just for as far as that 40,000 view look, you have cooperative extension and you have the universities, and then you also have in the US, we have a couple of sheep field stations that do work
right.
too. Do you want to give them a plug real quick?
Absolutely. So we've got the Dubois US Sheep Experiment Station in Idaho. That's operated by the USDA Ag Research Service. And that they do some tremendous work on genetics and grazing management and all sorts of things up there. Dr. Taylor was on our first season. There's another research center at Clay Center, Nebraska, Meat Animal Research Center. And I believe they do more than just sheep research, but they've got a lot of sheep research going on too. Many of the universities also have sheep units on campus and or research facilities, research ranches that they can do work on. So here in California, we've got the sheep unit at the Davis campus. The other ag schools in California, Chico State, Fresno State, Cal Poly, all have sheep units on campus as well. And then we've got the Hopland Research and Extension Center up on the North Coast here.
So then you have those organizations that can do or are interested in doing the research. And then the funding from that comes from a series of different grants or things like that. So you can get it from state agencies, USDA, federal agencies. You can get it from special interest groups. So like ASI gives out research grants, wool growers could do it. Pretty much anybody with money could fund a project.
Right.
And so then that's how that functions. And then the results of those go out. I guess they get dispersed, or the information learned from these studies kind of get dispersed through a myriad of publications and workshops that you just have to kind of pay attention to. It's probably one of the reasons why you should try to go to a ASI meeting or a wool growers annual meeting, or pay attention to some of the publications like California Farm Bureau does, things like that, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, your local extension person will be putting on workshops. All of the universities put on workshops. I think just tapping into that network is really valuable.
So then if I'm running a ranch and say I'm just starting in the sheep and don't have a lot of connections, and I got some grazing deal and I'm going on some feed and I don't know what this feed will do to these sheep, and I got a certain kind of sheep, and I want to kind of learn how to do it better. I'm kind of anticipating your answer, but I'll let you answer it. But how do you go about accessing that information? And then if that information doesn't exist, running a study that's not going to cost you a ton of money personally in running it?
That's a great question. And I'll kind of start with some research that Dr. Roach had also done about where ranchers get information. And I think you and I've talked about this before, kind of the most trusted source of information is other ranchers, right? So it's really important to kind of tap into that community, whether it's through an organization like ASI or California Wool Growers, or just finding out who your neighbors are. But the second piece of that answer would be call your local farm advisor. You know, start a relationship with your farm advisor. And they may not be as knowledgeable about sheep as somebody else, but they'll learn, and they're definitely able to bring kind of the scientific approach and potential funding to those questions. So I think that's part of my farm advisor job that I enjoy the most is getting questions from producers about things like you just described, and kind of figuring out where that information is and how to get it to them.
What do you think some of the underutilized information sources are that maybe, you know, commercial farmers or standard guys aren't really using? I mean, everybody goes to their neighbor.
Yep.
But, you know, what are some of the underutilized assets out there that you've found beneficial besides Sheep Stuff You Should Know podcast?
Well, that goes without saying, right? that's a good question. I think, you know, your farm advisor's newsletter and website is a good resource. And then their state websites, you know, the UC Rangelands website has a wealth of information about a whole variety of topics. I will say, and I get teased about this from my university colleagues a lot, that sometimes we need to remind researchers that sheep are livestock too. And that's okay to do. Mm-hmm. You know, to start asking sheep questions, and understanding that maybe the researcher you're asking hasn't ever looked at sheep, and this would be a great opportunity for him to do that.
Do you ever battle researchers wanting to spend research dollars, but not necessarily coming up with a practical, coming up with practical research? It's more just a funding. Something that's not practical. I don't know how to phrase that
absolutely. Correctly. But. Absolutely. I think that's a huge issue in our industry and in every other segment of the ag industry, really. I think, I think there's kind of two ways that research questions get turned into projects. And one is from the top down, which tends to be that kind of basic research that maybe doesn't have much practical application. I think it's far more valuable for those questions to come from the producer to the researcher, because then there's that practical application. So then to kind of
refine that or turn that question around, I guess the other question is, from a producer standpoint, how do you engage with people that want to do research and force them to make the research practical? You know, how do you work with them to help them to make it practical for what you're trying to learn?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. I think always bringing their focus back to the practical nature of the question. And for those of us that are doing this as a business, coming back to the business implications of the question. You know, I think, not to overemphasize the economics of this, but I think any kind of research project, for it to be of any value to industry, has to be tied back to the economics. Either it generates more, it helps us generate more income, it reduces our expenses, makes our operations more efficient. It's got to have some tie to the business of ranching for it to be of value to us at the ranch level.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I really like that focus. Try to pull it, make sure that there's an economic element within it, that it's realized that if the solution is spending $700 a head on your animal, it's not going to work practically. So
right,
you gotta get more creative with the solution that's being proposed.
Well, and I think a good example of that, we've done research on nutrition and on genetics and on ewe management to the point where we can get a 250% or 300% lamb crop, right? And for most of us, that's probably not profitable or realistic to spend all that money to get three lambs out of every ewe. Is not viable in terms of a business operation.
Yeah, not on a grass-based system for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
And it gets to the cost of bringing in those supplements to create that kind of nutrition plane, right?
And the labor required to take care of those extra lambs and all of those things, you know. I think that's where that conversation needs to happen between a rancher and a researcher. I think the practical implications of what the research is trying to answer is something only the rancher can really focus on and keep bringing the researcher back to reality, you know?
So I've been involved in a couple projects, and I don't know, some of them have been really beneficial and good, and I've enjoyed the process, but some of them, it seems like the work gets done and a rancher wants to know the answers quickly, right? We want to know, we put in the work, we want to know tomorrow what we did today, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And when you get into a research project, like there, a good example is a genetic thing that we just did. Yep. We did all this work. We pulled all these DNA samples. We did it back in December or before that. We did it in November, really. And now we're...
A year ago.
I guess a year ago, November. Yeah. So year 2019, right?
Yeah.
So here you are 14 months later, and we still don't have any real information from that. And I guess, how do you, as a producer or you know, on this end of the impatient side of the equation, how do you encourage that process to be practical, and how do you set your own expectations of research to make sure, because you do have to be very meticulous in research, mm-hmm. whereas on the ranch, you probably aren't as meticulous when it comes to controls and things like that. How do you navigate that, you know, correctly to get a result rather than just insult?
I think there's a variety of ways to approach that. I think it's really important for a researcher to provide realistic expectations on the time frame. But even when that's done, sometimes the time frame is beyond the researcher's control.
Well, and a lot of that is defining the outcomes or at the beginning rather than keeping them somewhat vague.
Right.
So a lot of it's in that initial planning.
And some projects do that better than others. Just like some things we do on the ranch work better than others. You know, I think that's part of the challenge. I think being really clear. So my perspective, and this isn't, I don't always do this well, but the only reason I would want to do research is so I can get it into the hands of people that can use it. And so probably to my own detriment, I'm not so focused on publishing a journal article as I would be on taking those results and doing a workshop and saying, I think this is what it means. How would this work in your operation? And I think that's, that can be a real value of cooperative extension in that there's more of a focus on the practical application, but that doesn't always happen. And I think that that can be frustrating from a rancher perspective.
So changing gears a little bit, how have you taken an on-farm issue or question and turned it into a research project?
Good question.
With outside funding. So you actually turned it into a legit research project.
Okay. So we're actually working on this right now. So we talked a little bit about the lambing system and the kind of the record keeping that we do on mothering ability. And my sense through observing our operation over time was that added data collection really helped us in selecting good mothers, and that had implications for us in terms of the labor at lambing time and the ability of a ewe to raise her lamb without much help. So I felt like just observing our little operation that it had some merit, but I didn't have any objective outside data to back that up. And I happened to meet a PhD student at a Superior event several years ago who was really interested in studying maternal behavior in sheep. And so she and I started a conversation. This would have been 2018, I think. And she started coming out when we were lambing and kind of observing what we were doing and working on a research question that she could answer through data that she could collect and analyze. And it turns out that she got funding through her fellowship at Davis to do this as part of her doctoral dissertation. And so it's not necessarily that we went out and got money to do it, but she's doing the work, she's providing interns, she's analyzing the data. I'm collecting data for her. So it's changed.
Yeah, but you found somebody with a passion. You saw somebody give a presentation at an event, you talked to her, and that created this opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think what's been really valuable for me about that relationship is that I'm able to keep saying, this is why it's important to me. This is why. If I can find a way to pick ewes out that are going to be good moms before I even put the ram with them, that has implications for me in terms of labor and cost of production. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, particularly with a younger person who's just coming into a PhD program, our education kind of starts really wide. And as we get further and further along, it gets narrower and narrower and more specialized. And what we as ranchers want is that wide view again, right?
Mm-hmm.
We want the big picture. And so having that relationship to be able to talk to Kalea about this project and relating it back to my concerns as a producer has been really helpful, just as it's been helpful for me to see the question through her eyes, because she looks at it from a totally different perspective than I would. But it starts with hearing that presentation and making that first attempt at building a relationship.
Yeah. What about the opposite of that? What about a project that you did on your own farm that you kind of answered your own question? How did you go about setting that up, and how do you do that in a practical way?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question too.
I'm changing gears, if you notice.
Yeah, Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. I think, you know, I think, so that I'm going to kind of take this a little different direction. And we've talked about this before in terms of data collection. You know, when we started, we collected everything we could think of in terms of data about what the sheep were doing. And then we realized that probably 2/3 of what we were collecting was not information that we could make a decision on. It was not something that we needed in order to be more efficient. And so we've kind of fine-tuned our data collection a little bit in that regard. I think one of the pieces of that, it's not necessarily an experiment, but it gets to how we manage. We pay pretty close attention to our estimates of forage ahead of us in our rotation. And to do that, we've collected data on how many sheep days per acre we're harvesting over the course of 7 or 8 years, which has trained my eye to the point where I can look at a piece of new feed and say, my 100 ewes can get 5 days of grazing there. And that's kind of through systematically collecting data in the past in a variety of different conditions and putting it in a format that I can go back and look at and use. So I guess that's not really an experiment, but it's certainly data that we collect in a consistent manner that allows us to make decisions on it going forward.
Yeah, I think you're. I'm going to keep trying to drive you to answer the question. So, I think you're touching on kind of your practices as an operation and how you set yourselves up to measure all of this data, but then when you have to prove those things out,
right?
And you can't make too many changes, and you can't go through one season, and because there's so many variables within a season. Like if I did, I don't know what the right thing would be, but say implants in cattle and compared this year to last year's gains. Well, I got no feed this year, so the gains are going to be worse, but that's not the implant that I was testing.
Right.
You know, so how on your plate, how do you kind of account for some of those variables? And how do you take data that you're collecting and begin to kind of sort that data and prove itself out? You know, it's basically you're running an on-farm experiment on your farm without losing money. You know, you got to make sure that you're functioning your business while testing these things. You know, how do you balance those things?
So I think the conclusion I've come to, Ryan, that's a different way to think about this. The conclusion that I've come to is that as a rancher, I can't afford a control versus treatment type of experiment. I can't have one group of sheep that I don't do. For example, let's say I want to find out if I've got resistance to my dewormers. I'm not going to not treat a group of sheep and see if they die, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to do that either. But I think we can collect data that tells us whether what we're doing has any efficacy.
So take that worming situation. You can't do a control, but what you can do is you can change your program and analyze that versus past years to know whether what you did makes sense or not. But you also have to account for all these variables.
And I think that's why we kind of think of it as a case study as opposed to a pure research project. So we write down all those other variables. And then if next year we try the same thing and it doesn't work as well, we can go back and look at how those variables changed from one year to the next.
Would you ever do, like, rather than have a controlled study where you don't do anything to, you have your last year's system and then make a change on a percentage to see how they do versus the other ones within your current year? So you're not doing nothing, but you're just making an adjustment on some to see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's that drives the pure researchers wild because you're not controlling all those variables. But from a ranch management standpoint, that's absolutely the way we do it. It's the way you do it too, I would suppose.
Absolutely.
And you know, another, and this is not really an experiment, but somebody with guard dogs, sometimes when I'm buying several bags of guard dog food every month, I wonder if the expense is worth it. And so we had a situation where we had a group of replacement ewe lambs with no dog available to them, and within one night had lost something to a coyote. So, you know, I'm not doing a strict control versus treatment experiment where I'm putting sheep out with no protection on purpose, but that kind of was an experiment, right? We know that if we're going to put sheep without a dog, we got to have some other kind of predator protection with them, or the coyotes will be there. And I think we all make little tweaks to our operations like that. I think part of it, Ryan, as I'm talking through this, is documenting what those tweaks were in a way that you can use them and refer back to it. So I think, you know, in talking with you, what you guys have done on your foot rot stuff, you're documenting who you're trimming, right? And
yeah,
that's kind of an experiment.
Yep.
To some degree.
Yeah. Have you ever had situations where you've made too many changes and you don't know what created the outcome, the positive outcome?
I have to think back on this.
Well, you're thinking I'll tell my story. So, and
yeah.
We changed the way we sourced rams. We changed from non-test quality alfalfa hay during lambing, and we incorporated a new mineral. And the result was a 15% increase in our lamb crop. But I don't know what of those three factors had any or no income. The mineral could have done everything and the other two did nothing.
Right.
The rams could have done everything and the other two did nothing. They all could have done something, and we had no way of knowing what specific thing it was. And so then over the following years, we began to play with our mineral and leave the other two factors constant. Or, you know, you're able to kind of start working back from there. But that was...
So how would you have done that in retrospect? Would you have staged that over the course of 3 years?
Yeah, I've kind of I try to make one change a year. Like if we're going to do a major change, it's going to be only one major change a year so that we can anecdotally look back and see whether we think it worked or not. If we're going to do a major change, the smaller things can happen throughout the year. That's not a big deal because they don't influence the herd on us on such a severe level. But
what's an example of a minor change?
Oh, it'd be like feeding loose mineral versus blocks.
Okay.
Just different grazing rotations, bunch sizes, just little things that are kind of more reactionary to the climate on the ground that are controlled by the weather or labor. Rather than like the way we source rams is a major change.
It's
the type of hay that we're buying is a fundamental. We're incorporating a brand new mineral mix. That's a major change. So And since then, on our mineral, when we started that, we changed this mineral and it was a great success with those other changes. We have since pulled that mineral way back out of our program because it's more expensive than our trace blocks. And we're feeding the blocks for 80% of the year and the loose for the balance, the 20%.
How did you determine that kind of optimal ratio?
Just little by little. And it's not perfect right now.
Yeah.
And there's so many. The other thing too is we don't necessarily know for sure because there's so many variations year to year, season to season, that the difference we saw when we switched could be explained away by 10 other factors.
Let me ask you this. Do you need solid concrete answers to all those questions?
No.
So you're comfortable working in that gray area, right?
When you're in livestock, especially on the commercial scale or on a commercial ranch, you work in trends. You don't work in specifics. If you're doing purebred, seed stock, stuff like that, then you're doing specifics. If you're working in the research and the science side of it, you're working in specifics. That's why you need controls. But if you're in a commercial operation, You can't afford to be specific. You have to work in trends.
And I think that's hugely important to convey to a researcher who may come to you with a project or who may ask you to be involved in a project.
Yeah. And I think that's where it comes back to that. The economics bring that out.
Yeah.
They illustrate the need for that. That's what you can't be specific because it's not economically feasible.
Yep.
And it's not that you're, you know, not taking care of the animals. It's that you won't be able to take care of the animals for the next 5 years if you do it.
You're right.
You do it great for 1 year and then you have to sell them and kill them the next year later. That's not taking care of them. You got to take care of them for their lifespan. So.
You know, it's similar to our conversation on risk to some extent that I think we as ranchers are probably more comfortable with uncertainty than maybe a researcher would be or even than most folks would be because we're dealing with that uncertainty on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think that really speaks to the kind of the urban rural divide that you get in the country now that if you grow up and live in the city, everything is controlled. Everything is made. Everything is fairly, I mean, you have weather and things, but for the most part, 90% of the year is controlled. If you're living in Eastern Montana, you control about 10% of what goes on out there.
On a good day.
Yeah. And so, it's very much when you're, you know, the more rural you get, the more into nature you are, the more you realize you're at the mercy of biology, which is ever changing and always working in trends. And so you accept that a lot easier.
Well, and I think you come to accept that you're working at the pace that the livestock allow you to work at, or that the year allows you to work at. And so,
yeah, you can't force stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I missed two meetings on Monday morning because I was dealing with a ewe that wasn't taking care of a lamb.
Yeah.
And so my decision was, I'm going to make sure this lamb stays alive and ask for forgiveness for missing a Zoom meeting, rather than coming back here at night and finding this lamb flat out in the pasture.
Well, if you get any flack next time, bring your cell phone and zoom in from there, and then you can have all the noises and sounds from the field.
I miss going to meetings with afterbirth on my hand. That's
I know, right? Those are the days. Those are the good old days. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, when you work with the outdoors, you have to accept some variability.
Mm-hmm.
I did one of my other favorite stories. So we AI'd some heifers and we synchronize them up. So we give them hormones leading up. And then when we actually put the semen, you're supposed to put a hormone, Factryl.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in my ignorance and speed, I didn't have the Factryl there when we were doing it. So we just started. And then, I called my vet after we had started and said, well, we got it. I guess I need some Factryl to give. And he's like, oh my goodness. So he ran down, went to, and so we gave half of them the Factryl and the other half we didn't give any to. And the studies and the science says you will lose 10 to 15% conception rate if you use one, if you don't use it, basically.
Yeah.
And so everybody was worried. The AI techs were worried their numbers were going to be way down and all that fun stuff. And so then we ended up, we have everything EID tagged. So then a month later, we went and ultrasounded, pregnancy scanned. And the ones that did not receive the Factryl bred up 1% higher than the ones that did.
So let me ask you this then.
Yeah.
What will you do next year?
We'll give the Factryl.
Okay.
Because what we experienced was an oddity in the biology, because the science isn't wrong. The science is right.
Okay.
But because you're working in trends and you're working with biology, you work with random, you know, things happen all the time.
And you've got all those other factors in your cattle that may have been different than the cows that were in the study too.
Right? Exactly. Exactly. And so you got to respect that science, but you also, I mean, it's biology. It's ever changing. It's always going to change. And yeah, I don't think I would test that again. I think we kind of got, we skated by just barely there. It worked good. There was actually one thing that was interesting with that was they had two techs and they alternated who AI'd what. So one would do one would do the other. And I don't know which one it was, but one of them, if you took the pregnancies and you put them up one guy versus the other guy, one guy bred 10% more cattle than the other guy. So there's a huge variation in the man doing the work. There was no variation in the hormone. That was another side factor that was fascinating.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this then. Where do you get information on research that's applicable to your operation?
Neighbors. Okay. Neighbors is definitely the first. But I would also say that your relationship with your vet opens up a ton of information. Having conversations with your veterinarian just really helps you a ton as far as knowing what's going on, knowing what's new. Your medicine sales reps are pretty good too, because they like selling new products, but they also kind of can key you in with different manufacturing reps and things. And as long as you go into it under the understanding that they are selling something,
right?
There's still a lot of really good information that is shared by them. So, you don't want to just brush them off because they're selling something. You want to listen, because sometimes what they're selling is really good.
So you got to just
kind of pay attention to that. But I'd say the medicine reps, your veterinarian is probably paramount. And then UC Extension is great. Your extension service is pretty, pretty fantastic. And then read articles and pull in information wherever you can.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole goal of this podcast really is to start conversations with people in the industry, among people in the industry. And that's where you're going to get a lot of your ideas and information and how to start looking at things a little different than if you're just talking to yourself. So,
well, and I think part of the idea of this podcast too is to open that discussion about new ways of looking at things and maybe looking at them. I think that's one of the benefits of having a large scale producer and a small scale producer talking too, because I think
I learn
something every time we talk, and I think we need to do more of that as an industry as well.
Yeah, me too. I agree. It's a lot of fun to do and I learn a ton, but yeah, it's a good venture.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it is. It is. You know, I guess the maybe one last thing to throw out there for us as a sheep industry, the California Cattlemen's Association was successful in getting this California Cattle Council established, as kind of a voluntary checkoff program to fund cattle focused research. And I think that's always been a challenge for us in the sheep industry is coming up with some funding to do some of these things that are important to us as industry. I don't know that we could ever do something of that nature, but it's a conversation I think we probably ought to have as an industry at some point.
Yeah. I think you'd struggle to get my vote on that one. I conversations always need to be had, but I guess one of the questions I would have or my impressions is it feels to me like there's a lot of sheep research interest and sheep research dollars that are out there. But it's hard to kind of bridge the academic nature of a lot of those projects and the commercial industry. I think that's probably one of the bigger struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think finding more research dollars might not necessarily work, especially in a industry that's contracting like the sheep have been in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll reserve my second comment about.
Let me put that back. Put this back to you. How do we improve communication between large scale commercial producers and folks that are interested in doing research?
Yeah, to me, I think the key is really starting to utilize the cooperative extension more. I think large scale producers tend not. Reach out because they tend to have a lot of neighbors and connections already that they lean on. It's not that they don't want to reach out. They're also very confident in what they're doing because it is very successful. So,
right.
I think there's some of that plays into it. But I do think, and then it's also where by sheep herders, especially the old school guys, are very independent by nature.
Right.
And so sharing your information on what you're doing on your ranch with everybody around you isn't necessarily the smartest business thing to do.
Right.
And so there's kind of that connotation on all of that, that makes it a little difficult. But to me, it's all just more conversations. It's, you know, it's going up to the presenter after a project and having a conversation. You know, nine of those conversations might come up with nothing, but it only takes one to actually help you on your place. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah.
And I, you know, next week we'll get to talk with Dr. Bush a little bit about some of these questions that we've got too. And I think that's a hugely valuable resource that we've got in California.
Yes. We're going to talk about weird sheep diseases, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. That'll be fun. I like that. I'll have to get my old book with pictures.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm going to go back and get my old books.
A practical guide to sheep management. That's good stuff. Well, thank you. I appreciate the conversation today. I hope it was informative. Hope maybe there's one person out in the audience that might reach out to an extension agent and this turns into something that helps them. And yeah, it was a good conversation. So I guess it's time to wrap up. So
always fun.
Yeah, for Sheep Stuff You Should Know, this is Ryan Mahoney signing off out of Rio Vista, California. And I thank again Dan Macon for making it and not getting blown away and taking a break from the Lamin and the Zoom meetings you're inundated with.
It's a welcome break. It's a welcome
break. Awesome. Well, look forward to seeing you next week, Dan.
Have a great week, Ryan. Thank you.
You too. Take care.
Bye.